So last time we did a calculation in Euclidean signature of the correlation functions, but now we want to do the same in the Lorentzian signature, and the metric of ADS 5 part of the 10-dimensional metric. So part of ADS 5 in Lorentzian signature is the usual Minkowski part, four-dimensional part, where A to mu nu is the diagonal minus 1, 1, 1, 1. And Z is the radial coordinate as before. So what we would like to do is to repeat basically the same calculation, but now we have the we have this Lorentzian signature, and that will affect rather significantly the calculations in the second part, in the second stage. So to begin with, so let's introduce the Fourier transform. Now I will write time and space coordinates separately. I have d4k over 2 pi to the fourth e to the minus I omega t plus ikx, where k is now a three-dimensional momentum. And again, there will be some function fk of z as before, multiplied by this normalization constant f naught of k, which plays the role of j. So we'll take a derivative with respect to j, with respect to phi naught, to find our correlators. Yep.
I have one question with respect to the result that we had yesterday. So we computed the correlation function between these two hyperboles, and it's algebraically decaying, right? Is that what one expects? Because it's like, it's reminiscent of criticality when correlation functions are not exponentially decaying, but just
yeah, we are in the conformal field theory, right? So we don't have any scale. So if you had, for example, a mass scale in the problem, then you would obtain the exponential e to the minus m times x minus y,
right?
We are in conformal theory where there is no m or anything like that, right? So so we do expect the only, so basically you can write down the expression for the correlator more or less immediately because of the absence of scale. The question is how this dimension, right? There could be an anomalous dimension of the operator due to the coupling constant lambda dependence, right? And that is a non-trivial question. But the fact that there is no other scale, so you have x, right? X minus y.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's no non-trivial scale to pair with. So it's
no. But then the computation we did yesterday is like when I have this action for the phi naught or well for your f, there was a master, right? That we set to zero for simplicity.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Doesn't that introduce a scale?
Yes, it does. It depends on so I put m to zero to make things look very simple, but you could remember that this is a mass in the bulk, right? And what you need to understand what this mass means in the boundary theory. So we will see in a moment that all of this is related to the conformal dimension delta of our operators, and that includes also m. So m enters the expression for the conformal dimension. M, if you're worried about the normalization or dimensionality, then remember that we had in the bulk we had also L, right, the radius of ADS, and the dimensionless parameter that we'll be dealing with will be M times L. So this is the bulk side, okay, and this thing will translate into the boundary into the same dimensionless parameter delta. We'll see this in a moment. I will write down the expression for massive deltas as well. Okay, so Fine. So we do exactly the same as before. We insert this phi into the action for the scalar field, just like we did yesterday. And the expression after integrating by part in the action is the following. It's the integral over d4k to pi to power 4. And then there is this function f, which we introduced last time. I will write this in a moment explicitly. And here, this phi naught of minus k, where it took into account the presence of a delta function already, where f of k and z was this boundary term, which includes the full normalization, L to the eighth. And here we have 4 kappa squared 10 dimensional Newton's constant. And here I have f minus k, dz, fk, right? So this is, you take a derivative, and then there is this part which comes from the metric z cube. So, so this is our action. So do this as an exercise. I mean, you should be kind of fluent in doing this type of thing. So substitute twice phi into the action with k and k prime, and then integrate by parts, and you should recover this expression of this type. Now, so this object will be of primary importance. But first, let's write down the equations of motion and discuss the boundary conditions. Right, so the equation of motion that follows from the action is, of course, very similar to the one we had last time. So 3 minus z f prime k minus, here we have k squared, and I will include mass for a moment, and then we'll talk about this mass. Maybe put it to 0 if I have simplified calculations, but okay, so that will not be important. So so here is the equation of motion, and so I will write down the recipe for the correlator, and then we will try to justify why this recipe is valid. So I will try to not to erase this part. So the claim, right? So the recipe for computing the retarded correlation function. So remember that we expect in Lorentzian signature in Minkowski space, we expect the variety of correlators, not only the unique correlator. And we also had the number of formulas on board a couple of days ago or some days ago, where we expressed effectively all correlation functions in Lorentzian signature through the retarded one. So if we know the retarded correlator, then everything else can be recalculated from it. So that's the only thing that we'll actually need. Now, this correlator as a function of k will be, so this is a recipe which I will, as I said, I will try to justify later. But I want this recipe to appear on board now with epsilon, as usual, taken to 0. And here, of course, we do this thing, which is a poor man's holographic renormalization, meaning discarding the contact terms. All right. So you can notice immediately that that things are slightly so it's similar to what we had before. So this factor of -2 comes from simply the fact that this is a quadratic thing in f naught. So we take derivative with respect to f naught, and there is a factor of 2. But then the appearance of this f is interesting, because if you look at the action, so naively looking at the action, you can see that the action on shell reduces to 2 pieces, right? And in the Euclidean signature, it was also the case, but in Euclidean signature, we had a unique solution with the boundary condition at the horizon, at the Poincaré horizon at z equal to infinity, such that the solution was proportional to e to the minus kz, And therefore, it vanishes at the horizon. So this contribution was identically zero. Now, in Minkowski, in Lorentzian signature, this contribution will not be zero. And then you will see that, in fact, we'll need to actually, with some cavalier sort of approach, we need to discard this contribution by hand. And then it can be justified by some more careful consideration. But it will be so. But OK, so let's proceed with equations of motion to construct a solution. Yeah, of course, there are, there are boundary conditions which we'll need also to discuss. So first of all, because we have a Lorentzian signature, we have two cases. So one of them is space-like momenta. Then k squared in our chosen signature is greater than zero. And in this case, if you recall from yesterday, this is the same calculation as in Euclidean case. Euclidean case, so we compute the solution, so everything is exactly the same. Now, the interesting case is the case of time-like momenta. Because so k squared less than zero, so let q, so introduce q, which is the square root of minus k squared, and minus k squared is positive, and we will call this the magnitude of k, right? We call this q, right? So q is the magnitude of k for time like k. Now the solution in this case. Right, the solution, so k squared is less than zero, so here we have a minus sign. And you can solve this equation again. So the solution should probably be a different word. So the solution. So the equation of motion is given by the combination of Hankel functions. So we will normalize them to one at epsilon as before, right? So normalized to one at z equal epsilon, right? So that's our recipe at the boundary. So qz normalized by epsilon squared h1 nu of qz and z squared h nu 2 of qz normalized by epsilon squared h nu 2 of qz. So this is for omega greater than zero. This is for omega less than zero, where Hankel function, I remind you, h nu of 1 or 2 is j nu plus minus I y nu. So these are generic Bessel functions. It's advisable, so you can obtain the solution with the help of Mathematica, but if you want to be serious, then you need to look at books on special functions and remind yourself how these special functions are constructed and why and when do we have the Hankelison, because ultimately. So this is all the selection. This is one special function in some sense, but different analytic sort of branches, analytic continuations of it. So we can have either modified Bessel functions or the usual Bessel functions, of which, of course, there are two, Rubik's second order differential equation. So typical Dörfer functions will be jnu and ynu, nu, sometimes called also Neumann function, n. In some sense, so Hankel is in some sense are analogs of, so you can think in some philosophical sense that your Bessel equation is a generalization of your harmonic oscillator, right? And depending on the signs, on the sign of k squared, you can either have the solutions of two exponents with plus minus kz, right? That's modified Bessel functions, or you have two exponents with ikz, right? Plus minus ikz, right? So that's the case here. And out of two exponents with plus minus ikz, you can form sine or cosine. And these Hankels are analogs of this sine and cosine, right? So that's kind of the underlying story. The asymptotic expansions of H's, which will be important. So this is the asymptotic expression for large z. So it has this iz, so that kind of justifies this sine and cosine analogy to some degree, pi over 4, plus higher terms. And again, so this is not a regular, this is not a Taylor expansion, this is an asymptotic expansion, so hence this is asymptotic series, it's not the Taylor series, but the appearance is quite obvious. So minus I, and that we have z minus nu p over 2 minus pi over 4, and then there are other terms in the asymptotic expansion. So what is important here is this plus or minus, right? So that's why I said that these things will have this role. That J and Y play a role of sine and cosine, but this plus or minus gives you exponents, right? So one sine or the other. Now, note one thing that. So this is you can convince yourself that this is indeed the solution of the differential equation, but now let's look at the property. So it is normalized to one at z equal epsilon, that by design. But what happens at large z? So at large z, we have this wave-like behavior, and so our functions, unlike the modified Bessel functions of which one was blowing up at Poincaré horizon at z equal to infinity, and the other was benign, right, e to the minus kz. So here, both of these solutions are perfectly fine. They are oscillating. Nobody is blowing up, and you can happily choose, right? So you can happily choose these both of these solutions to be your to be the solutions of your differential equation. But we need some boundary conditions on the Poincaré horizon. And one natural boundary condition, so that you can, so suppose that this is your Poincaré horizon at z equal to infinity. And you have, so this is wave behavior. So you have your, effectively, your scalar field waves. You can have waves going into the horizon, and there are waves going out of the horizon. And one can look, so remember that we had a Fourier, right? So we decomposed this thing into Fourier transform, and the time dependence of the Fourier was e to the minus I omega t. So you can have waves which behave like minus I omega t, for example, plus I qz, right? So this, not a very good. So let me reinstate. I mean, this is for generic z, but we have this. Okay, so let me put q here, just to be consistent with the notations here. That's irrelevant, right? So if you choose if you choose the Hankel one, then your asymptotic including the time dependence, will be given by this exponent. And the constant phase, so you have this wave, right? And the constant phase of your wave, so for example, you look at the maximum of your wave, and you see how this thing propagates in time. So the constant phase, right? So constant phase would correspond to the condition that omega dt, right? So you just take the phase of this exponent and take a differential, and omega dt plus q dz equal to zero, right? The constant phase, and this tells you that dz over dt, right? So remember, this is our z. Dz over dt is simply omega over q. So for positive omega, right? So q is always positive, right? Q is the magnitude of k. So for positive omega, so this is greater than zero with this choice of sign in our solution. And that means that our wave, right? So dz over dt is the velocity of this phase, of this maximum, for example. And this means that the velocity of this maximum is positive. So this means that the wave propagates towards the Poincaré horizon here. So this means that if you pick out of these two solutions, if you pick the one with H1, right, this one for omega greater than zero, then we choose the wave which propagates into the Poincaré horizon, not the one which propagates out of it. Okay, because in principle you have a choice, right? Your H1 and H2 are perfectly good solutions of your differential equation, and you need to make a choice which one to pick. So you pick one which corresponds to a wave ingoing into the horizon, incoming into the horizon, right? Which is a natural sort of physically, if you want, it's a natural choice, because once you have a horizon, at least classically, you can think also this is a black hole horizon, because we have chosen a zero temperature case just for simplicity. But later today, probably we'll discuss a finite temperature case in which this horizon will be the usual black hole horizon, and then the waves that will propagate into the horizon, classically, they will never come back, will never emerge from the horizon. So a natural boundary condition, a physical boundary condition for your waves is the incoming wave boundary condition. So it goes into the horizon, nothing classically goes out. Okay? So that's a choice. That's a choice. And so this means that for omega greater than zero, we choose h nu 1 of qz as our solution, and that corresponds to so-called incoming wave boundary condition at the horizon. All right, any questions at this point? That's relatively straightforward, but it is important, because all calculations of Minkowski space correlators in gravity are done with this recipe. So if you're planning to do something yourself, and that's all right. So fine. So then if this is fine, then this is indeed the correct solution they wrote, right? So again, so a priori, you could have chosen here two, not one, but that would be violating the incoming wave boundary condition. So for omega greater than zero, I choose H1. For omega less than zero, for the same reason, I have to choose H2. And this is my solution obeying the incoming wave boundary condition. So this is a solution obeying the incoming wave boundary condition at the horizon z equal to infinity and normalized to one at the boundary, right? So that's our solution with which we built a correlator. Okay. Now so that's the solution. We take the thing and we do exactly what we did last time for the Euclidean case using this recipe. So then the retarded Yeah, so the claim is that the correlator of this type of boundary conditions, right? So I said that you have variety of correlators in the Lorentzian signature, and it turns out that this specific correlator with this type of boundary condition would correspond to the retarded one. And if you are interested, for example, in the advanced correlator, then your boundary condition should be the outgoing one. And then the combination of various correlators would give you the Feynman, Weidman, and so on. So the retarded correlator, then, according to the recipe, is minus 2. And then there is this limit of epsilon going to 0 of f of k and epsilon with this holographic renormalization kind of reducing to basically discarding the contact terms. Now, you may ask also why. So this somehow it doesn't look completely satisfactory because in comparison to what we did yesterday, because you can also say that I know that asymptotics, so my functions, right, they're not vanishing. So these functions are not vanishing at the horizon. In fact, if you substitute them into this f, right, so these functions, if you substitute them into f and look at these asymptotics, you discover that the contribution from the horizon, this one, is actually non-zero. So if you want to be, if you want to kind of do it by the Euclidean book, so to speak, you would have to keep the contributions from both boundaries, so to speak, right? So one from the actual boundary and one from the horizon, and then the answer would be incorrect. In particular, the answer will have zero imaginary part, which is wrong. We know that in Minkowski space, the correlators must have typically have non-zero imaginary parts. So the recipe on this level is very brutal. We just declare that we have to put this thing to zero by hand, so discard it completely, and take only this part here, not this one. And then this is the recipe. And I claim that this recipe is correct. But of course, you would feel some degree of dissatisfaction, right? So I take some finite part and I just declare that this must be discarded. And indeed, so this recipe was formulated in 2002, and shortly afterwards, well, about a year or so, I don't remember, there was an explanation of why we need to throw away this horizon contribution. And this explanation is a rather beautiful. So you can consult this paper by Chris Herzog and Dem Son, where they showed that what happens actually, so this calculation was done with the help of Poincaré horizon in coordinates. So imagine that you have a black hole. So this is a zero temperature case, but it's the same thing goes through, in fact, essentially identical in the recipe if you have a real black hole. So for a real black hole, what you need to take into account is the Penrose diagram, right? So you have a Penrose diagram for your black hole, and in fact, the recipe is naturally formulated in terms of the full Penrose diagram, not just one region, right? So we have region 1, 2, 3, and 4, and you have to take into account. So this whole thing, there is a recipe which relates this whole diagram to the so-called Schwinger-Keldysh real-time formalism. And that justifies. So if you formulate this recipe with this full Penrose diagram, then what happens is that in this language, automatically the contribution from the horizon here will be canceled by the contribution of the horizon here. So it will, you don't have to do anything by hand. It will automatically cancel each other. And moreover, you will get in Schwinger-Keldysh real-time formalism. In fact, you have what you get is the metrics of your Green's functions, which has the same the structure, and it contains the retarded and advanced correlator at the same time, and then there are some other correlation functions appearing on the off-diagonal elements. So there is a generalization of this simple recipe, but it confirms in a way that this choice was correct. This choice was correct. Now, and then people tried to kind of generalize this even further. So you can look at papers by Skenderis and collaborators, and that's more recent, something like 2010 or 11. I don't quite remember. With kind of generalizing this even further. But the bottom line is that for all practical calculations in the real time holography, unless I'm not aware of. Yeah. So at the moment, I'm not aware of a situation where you need anything beyond that. So that's a very simple recipe. Which we will use. So you have to do exactly what we did last time, right? So take the solution, expand for small epsilon. So take the derivative according to what f is, right? So f contains one derivative with respect to z. Then expand for small epsilon. So you'll get a series. In this series, you discard all terms which are higher order in epsilon, right, in the limit of epsilon going to zero, but you also discard contact terms of the type, like for example, k squared, for example, over epsilon squared or something like that, right? So that will be discarded, and the result of this calculation will be the following. So I ask you to do this as an exercise, and so explicitly. Explicitly combining space-like and time-like results, we find the following, that the retarded correlation function as a function of k is n squared c, k to the fourth over 64 pi squared. Here we have log of the magnitude of k squared minus I times pi theta minus k squared, and then the signature of omega. Right. So you can easily see that, yeah, so you can think so sine of omega is of course it's plus one when omega is positive and minus one when omega is negative. Now the theta function again is one then the argument is positive and zero then the argument is negative. So you can see that it might have an imaginary part for specific values of k squared of a particular sign. So the small exercise for you is so exercise, show that the analytic continuation of G Euclidean that we had on board last time gives this G retarded, right? So of course analytic continuation, the appropriate, right? So appropriate analytic continuation. Well, remind yourself, right? So how you go from Euclidean correlator with the appropriate recipe, you derive all the correlators like Feynman and retarded advanced and so on with the appropriate sort of contour prescription. So think about this for a while, remind yourself how this goes, and prove that the simple expression that we had last time, namely k to the fourth proportional to k to the fourth log k squared, right, gives under the appropriate analytic continuation precisely this expression that we obtained from gravity. So this expression we just computed from gravity using this recipe. Okay? So this justifies a posteriori, it justifies that our prescription here and here was correct, because we know that Euclidean one is correct, and then we check that analytic continuation would give exactly what we obtained from gravity. Okay? So that's a good news. Now we are armed now with this recipe and can put it to a good use. But let me say at least a few words about a more generic case, because we consider it for simplicity. We took the simplest possible case of ADS-FT calculation of correlation functions, the massless, minimally coupled massless scalar in the bulk of ADS. That's kind of the basic example of Gubser, Klebanov, and Polyakov, now generalized to the Lorentzian signature. But let's see what happens in a more general case. And you can even, so let's say, more general case. Well, first of all, you can repeat all, obviously, these computations for d-dimensional or d plus one dimensional ADS. And again, you can do it in Lorentzian signature. Now the equation of motion, so equations of motion for a minimally coupled massless or massive, yeah, let's include mass scalar. In this case, will be z to power d plus 1. So again, this is an exercise for you to derive this equation of motion. Z1 minus d, dz acting on phi, minus k squared z squared phi, minus m squared l squared phi equal to 0. So here we have K squared is minus omega squared plus the vector k squared. And we can look at this differential equation. And near the boundary, and that equal to epsilon, right? Going to 0, right? So near the boundary, the solution of this equation has the following form. So there is some coefficient a of k z to power d minus delta plus higher terms plus the other solution, which starts with z to power delta, where delta here is d over 2 plus nu, and nu is the square root of d squared over 4 plus m squared l squared. Okay, so I will comment on that. But first of all, so you can see that. That's the answer to your question, right? So you can see that the mass we have massive modes, right? The mass is transformed into, translated into this index nu, which in turn is part of the conformal dimension of your operator, right? So remember that this whole thing would be dual to the correlator of the type 1 over x minus y to power 2 delta, okay? And this delta has this dependence on the massive modes in ADS. In fact, that was one of the sort of non-trivial predictions that immediately emerged from this holographic calculation, because we are looking at string theory on ADS 5 crosses 5, and we can see the split of all the excitations that can propagate in this background into two classes. So the one class would be these excitations of the supergravity, massless or massive, because remember that here we are dealing with ADS part of the 10-dimensional metric. But if you start with massless, so the supergravity multiplet that we discussed some lectures ago, right, and you dimensionally reduce in the 5 sphere, that is a non-trivial exercise of how you take all these forms and all these fields and actually do this dimensional reduction, that was done in the 1980s. And that results, because of the dimensional reduction, the Kaluza-Klein reduction, you will get the massive modes propagating on ADS5. But all these modes are classified, so we know what they are. Okay? Now, in addition to that, there could be other modes which come from the massive string excitations in 10 dimensions. Right? So those modes will have, so all these modes that I talked about just before, right? So the modes that come from Kaluza-Klein reduction, by design, because the sphere has a radius equal to radius of ADS equal to L. So by design, all those modes will have masses which are proportional to 1 over L. Okay, so you have like you reduce something on the circle of radius R, and this dimensional reduction will give you masses of these Kaluza-Klein excitations of the order of 1 over R. There's some coefficients which come from geometry. Okay? So for those modes, we know that masses in this supergravity sort of excitations that come from Kaluza-Klein reduction, all of them will have some proportionality of 1 over L, and therefore this will be some finite number. I mean some finite in the sense that it will not depend on L. So also ML will be given by some number which is of order 1, roughly speaking. But then on the other hand, there will be contributions from the stringy mode that we're propagating in ten dimensions, and if you do the dimensional reduction, so these modes will have masses of the order of M string. And these M strings, this means that they will be proportional to 1 over L string. And here, therefore, it will be this piece will be proportional to capital L over L string squared. Okay? And this is a very, very large number in the limit we are working with, right? So it means that there will be a number of correlation functions in the limit of lambda going to infinity and n going to infinity with extremely large conformal dimensions. Right. So that's our recipe tells us. Okay. All right. Then the second remark, which is perhaps more fundamental, is how you deal with, in general, with differential equations. So that will happen time and again if you work with holography. So you have some background, you have some excitations on this background, which are described by linearized equations of motion. And those linearized equations of motion will give you second order differential equations, in general, partial differential equations. But if you're considering your fluctuations, which can be translated which can be represented by the Fourier transform, in other words, whose time and x dependence is given by that exponent there, right? So you don't expect any inhomogeneous or anisotropic dynamics happening in your geometry. Then it follows that your partial differential equations effectively will be converted into the ordinary differential equations with respect to the radial coordinate, right? So all the non-trivial dependence on x and time will be converted into k, right, via Fourier transform. And this is algebraic piece. And the only non-trivial piece from the point of view of differential equations will be ODE. So this will be ODE, second order ODE, with a certain type of boundary conditions in your bulk. Okay. Now, a little piece of a theory of ordinary differential equations that if you don't know it, I mean, this is the time to learn it. I mean, it's useful not only for holography, but for many other applications, is the following, that when you have a differential equation of a type, for example, y double prime of x plus, let's say, a of x y prime plus b of x y equal to 0, right? So this is ODE, second order. First of all, one thing that you typically do is you consider this equation as the equation in the complex domain of your variable, even if your variable, like here, for example, our z is real, right? So this is our coordinate in the metric, but it is useful to consider this variable as a complex variable. And you can look at the singularities, an analytic structure of the coefficients a and b, right? So look at, for example, singularities of a and b. And here, for example, this differential equation, okay, so the one that we had there, upstairs, right? So it is obvious, right? So the term a, which happened to be minus 3 over z in that example, contains obvious singularity at z equals 0. It's a pole, simple pole. And then there is a double pole at z equals 0 again in the coefficient b, right? The coefficient b has this with some residue which depends on mass, right? So that's minus m squared l squared over z squared for a small z. All right, so these are singularities. And in general, you can analyze how many singularities do you have, including also z equal to infinity. Right? So the analysis of a singularity at z equal to infinity is the simplest way to do it is to do the change of variables and then look at vicinity of w equal to 0. You, of course, you convert your equation, right? You have to recalculate the derivatives, and then. So normally, you may or may not find, so it may or may not be singular. When you find the number of singularities, then there is a fairly simple theory that would classify your differential equations, or ODEs, according to the number of singular points. So these points are known as singular points. And there is a theory which classifies your differential equations according to the number of singularities they have. And this is quite an important piece of kind of common knowledge, if you want. And you can read, so the source of wisdom, well, there are many sources of wisdom on this topic, but one of them is, for example, this two-volume set of Morse and Feshbach, Methods of Theoretical Physics, which I was very happy to discover in the perimeter of the library downstairs, which has a chapter on ODEs, and it classifies these singular points. The useful thing of it is the following, that your equation, of course, can be written in different coordinates, right? So it's like tensor. You can choose a different coordinate system, and even equation for a harmonic oscillator could be written in some horrible coordinates in such a way that you never recognize them. But the number of singularities and the type of singularities, these are invariants, so they don't lie, right? So once you have some horrible differential equation, you discover via this simple analysis that it has, for example, three singular points, then you know that your equation is a hypergeometric equation, period, and therefore you know the exact solution. It may be written in horrible coordinates, but you know that, that the equation is solvable. Okay? So this is a useful tool to check. So for our purposes, it will be enough to remember that that the analysis, so the analysis of the singularities is typically goes by the name of Frobenius theory. And one other book to consult is a book by Ainz, but you can look at any any other book. The first thing, so the Frobenius theory tells you the following, that if you have this number of, so suppose this is a complex plane. This is a complex plane of Z, your variable. And suppose your ODE has a number of singularities. So for example, at 0, maybe 1, maybe somewhere else, and maybe at infinity as well, right? So some singularities. Then these singularities are classified into two types with somewhat unfortunate name. So there are so-called regular singularities, or regular singular points, and irregular ones. Irregular ones. So basically, the regular singularities are the singularities which. So suppose we change the coordinates in such a way that our singularity is at z equals 0, right? We can always shift kind of coordinates to talk about z minus z naught, but let's talk about z naught equal to 0. So singularity at z equal to z naught is regular if the behavior of a of z, if coefficient a of z has a simple pole and no worse than that, right? So it could be a regular function. So it could be, for example, of order 1 or z squared or z to the 6. But it cannot be 1 over z squared, 1 over z cubed, and so on, right? So no worse than simple pole. Simple pole. And the coefficient of B is no worse than double pole. Right? So if these conditions are satisfied, then the singularity will be called regular at z equals 0. And the same at any other point, including infinity. Right? And if this condition is not satisfied, then it is the irregular singular point. So you can look at differential equations which govern the fluctuations of typical backgrounds that you encounter in general relativity. So for example, asymptotically flat Schwarzschild black hole, or asymptotically ADS black hole, right? And or any favorite black hole you want. And you can look at the classification of these singularities. So these singularities, remember what kind of metric, because of course, these coefficients, obviously, they depend on G mean nu. So in a way, these singularities, they remember what kind of metric is there. And in fact, all fields, so you can consider form fields, Maxwell field, and the scalar field, the Antar field, and so on, and gravity fluctuations on this background. And the singularities of these ODEs will be always the same. Okay, so they will be tied to the particular background. So in particular, if you look at asymptotically flat solutions, asymptotically flat backgrounds, and you look at the fluctuations of these backgrounds, the simplest example being the four-dimensional asymptotically flat Schwarzschild, but you can also look at black brain, that the solution that we considered, you discover that r equal to infinity is the irregular singular point for the differential equations which govern the fluctuations of this one. Now, for asymptotically ADS case, and that's one we are mostly interested in, all singular points of our ODEs will be regular singular points. Okay. Now, the other remark is the following. Yeah. Okay. So I let me finish probably with this Frobenius thing. So if it happens that your singularity is regular, then the Frobenius theory applies. And the Frobenius theory, I remind you that Frobenius is famous for other things as well, but it's referred to ODE. The Frobenius theory simply tells you that if you have a regular singular point, then you can build a serious solution to your differential equation as a convergent series around this singular point. And the radius of convergence of the series, it's called Frobenius series, and the radius of Frobenius series will be bounded by the presence of the nearest other singularity, right? So if you're building solution around zero, right, then the radius of convergence of your Frobenius series will be bounded by the presence of another singularity. And there are some theorems, there are some conditions which tell you whether or not the series will converge at one in this case, right? And then it doesn't, right? So this is a completely regular, so this is convergence series. It's very important because of course when you solve differential equations, as we I think discussed in one of the lecture, if you start building your solution at any point, for example, a singular point or a regular point, doesn't matter, because it's a second order differential equation, locally you have two solutions. Okay? And this is true for any other point as well. And in principle, you could say, okay, great, I just write down, and we know how to do it, if you write down the solution in the form of a series, so y is equal to sum over some coefficients an, for example, zn, right? N equals from 0 to infinity, right? So this is your solution. You substitute in the differential equation. You reduce it to the finite difference equation for an. And you can say, OK, great, so I know all the coefficients. Fine, so I'm solved the equation. That's not the case. You did construct a series. And this series, in the case of regular singularity, will be convergent series. But it's not enough to declare that you solve the differential equation, because what you need is the you have to solve the so-called connection problem. You need to know how these two solutions, so this is solution number one, right? So y1, and then the solution y2, say some bn, zn, n from 0 to infinity, and the linear combination of these two solutions with some coefficients a and b, or alpha and beta, will be the local solution around 0. What you have to do to solve the differential equation is to tell how this alpha and beta, the coefficients in front of the series, are related to the coefficients of gamma and delta of, for example, a Frobenius series built around 1, because somebody can start around 1 and build a similar Frobenius series around 1 with a radius of convergence obviously bounded by the next singularity. And the connection problem is the relationship between the coefficients alpha and beta, and then gamma and delta of these local solutions. If you know how to connect them, what they are equal to, right, to how they are related to each other, then indeed you can say, and you can do it for any singular point. Then indeed you have a global solution of the differential equation. So normally this is done with the help of integral representation, and it is an extremely non-trivial task to the degree that, the equations with, for example, with one regular singularity is a trivial equation, it's a trivial solution, so that is known. With two singularities, similar story. With three singularities, it's already non-trivial, it's known as a hypergeometric equation, and so on. hypermetric functions, that's already a rather non-trivial case. If you have four regular singular points, the global solution is unknown. Okay, so if you happen to find to solve the connection problem for the ODE with four regular singularities, then with high probability your name will be attached to the solution forever, just like Bessel and Riemann and so on. Right, so it is a non-trivial thing. But locally, the solution can be built rather easily, and it is important to understand that this is a convergent solution. Okay, so last remark for today is we had this new here, right? We had this new. So notice that new is real. So new here is real for masses which are bounded by minus t squared over 4. And this is negative, right? So you could say that, okay, so we are talking about mass squared, which can be negative, but not too negative, right? It should be greater or equal of this to this negative number. So this is known as Breitling-Locher-Friedman bound. In your tutorial, so you can look at this beautiful paper by these authors, and I highly recommend you actually to read it, because it's a classic sort of thing in Annals of Physics in 1982, so long before stuff was started. But when you consider the propagation of the scalar fields in anti-de Sitter background, the thing is that when you write down the equation for a minimally coupled massless for a massless scalar generically, you will discover this is your tutorial exercise. You will discover that your propagating mode will not be tachyonic, even if mass, in the standard sense of this word, the mass which enters the action, mass squared is negative, right? And that is due to the fact that you are dealing with a space of non-zero curvature, and the mass squared term will enter the equation together with this contribution from the curvature term. So if you get rid of the first derivative in your differential equation, effectively you will get the Schrodinger equation with a particular potential. And this potential will reflect the fact that you are in a space with non-zero curvature, and therefore it's not m squared greater than zero that would guarantee the absence of tachyonic excitations, but it is m squared greater than something negative, right? Because of its curvature presence, right? So similar thing happens if you have excitations in a sphere, for example, and you have a contribution to the mass, which would reflect the fact that you're dealing with a curved manifold. Okay, this is known as BF bound, which plays an interesting role in ADS CFT. So all right. So tomorrow we will discuss the elements of relativistic hydrodynamics. So I remind you that the goal for the rest of this week is the same as before. We want to compute the correlators of some operators. Some of this you will do in tutorials. So J mu, for example, J nu and T mu nu of K T rho sigma of minus K at finite temperature, and look at the excitations, at the lowest excitations, which manifest themselves as poles of the correlation functions, and compute this excitation from gravity. So a simple theorem using this recipe, a simple theorem which we'll discuss tomorrow, tells you that the poles, the sequence of poles in the correlation functions is equivalent to the sequence of so-called quasi-normal modes, quasi-normal excitations of your dual gravity background. And we do explicit calculation. I hope at least we'll have time to do this calculation, that would show that these lowest line poles or the lowest line quasi-normal modes of the gravitational background would correspond to the usual quasi-particle excitations in our dual quantum field theory at finite temperature, namely propagation of sound, the propagation of momentum, and so on. This is prescribed with the coefficients which are predicted by the usual relativistic hydrodynamics. Okay? So tomorrow we'll discuss this relativistic hydro, and then we do this calculation on Thursday and Friday. All right.